It's Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the donkey and the elephant are two animals famous for representing the United States' two most prominent political parties. On Election Day, we'll learn about the origin of these political mascots.
First, 300 is a magic number for corn farmers because a crop yield of 300 bushels per acre means it's been a near-perfect growing season.
Many Wisconsin corn farmers will reach that magic number this year because of good weather conditions. Soybean farmers are also expected to see bumper crop yields.
But with all this good news, there's also a downside. Prices have dropped to record low levels. Chris Robinson joins us now. He's Senior Risk Management Specialist with Top Third Ag Marketing, LLC. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Kate. Nice to be here.
Explain for us, what are the conditions that have led to this record yield year for Wisconsin farmers and farmers across the Midwest?
Well, yeah, combination. It was really a Garden of Eden growing season, and we've seen this before. With the if you get very good growing conditions, the American farmer is very good at producing a large crop. And typically, in a marketing year, we'll have some sort of a drought issue or too much rain issue. But really, we're kind of in the sweet spot when you look at across the entire nation, especially in Illinois, the Iowa states, Iowa, Illinois, but also Wisconsin. So you just kind of had the perfect conditions. And it's interesting because at the beginning of the year, a lot of people were concerned that we might have a La Nina drought. The first 3-4 months of the year, we thought that we may be looking at a situation where we'd have crop losses because of lack of rain. But we got through the middle of the summer, and you know the rain was good, and we got through the critical pollination period for corn. And lo and behold, we're looking at record yields and a very, very large crop, over a 15 billion bushel corn crop and over a 4 billion bushel soybean crop.
And put this in perspective, how does this year's bumper harvest compare to previous years? Because in 2011, there was also a record?
Yeah, in 2011, we had a good crop. And then 2014, a lot of the Iowa states also had a very good year. But it had been cyclical, kind of rolling through the different parts of the country, had good yields. We had drought issues, obviously, in the Southwest and down some weather issues down the Delta. But this was the one year where, by and large, and I think that was a big difference, across the country, we had very good growing seasons. Usually we'll have a year where it's too dry out in the west, or it's not enough rain somewhere else, or too much rain somewhere else. But in general, there were no real hiccups. And when you combine modern technology with the good seeds that we have, you see it all came to fruition. We just had a great yield. And so now we're dealing with the repercussions of that because of the large supply, supply and demand. We've had lower prices because of the increased supply. So that's potentially hurt the bottom line of not only Wisconsin farmers, but also farmers across the nation.
Yeah, explain for us the price of corn right now, and it's considered below the farmers' break-even point. How are farmers going to respond to this challenge?
Yeah, well, that's historically that happens. There are times when the markets where the prices are great, and the end price far exceeds what it costs to put a crop in. But right now, the break-even price for corn, and generally there may be some differences, but across the country it's about $4.20 to $4.30. Most of our clients, that's their area where they're paying their bills, they're covering their input costs, they're making their operating loans, and the business is running well. So when you drop below that, you're under the price of production, and just like everything else, you have to look at a farmer like a factory. If you're building a product and it costs you X amount of dollars to produce it, and you're selling it for X minus whatever, that's a losing proposition. So can we get through a year or two of that? Probably. If most farmers, if you turn the clock back to where we were between 2008 to 2013-14, we actually had very, very good prices. It was a very good time for farmers and producers. But here, lo and behold, we've had this large supply, which has pushed prices down. And we're really looking at at the lowest prices we've seen in corn in over 7 years, and that's affected some farmers. Now, better farmers, better producers, guys who have planned better, they'll be in a better shape. But somebody that's on the thin line of margins, especially if they're borrowing money to plant their crop, they're going to have to make a business decision in the next year or two what they're going to do.
We're talking with Chris Robinson. He's Senior Risk Management Specialist with Top Third Ag Marketing, LLC. Chris, talk to us a little bit about the quality that we're seeing coming in from the harvest with the corn yield.
Yeah, by and large, it's been excellent quality as well. There have been some isolated cases of blight and fungus and stuff, and things like that, but in general, this is an excellent crop. And it's one of the things that, moving forward, sometimes it can be a double-edged sword. When prices get cheap enough, people tend to not really care about quality. The one issue that is kind of out of whack right now, there's a shortage of high-protein wheat right now. And if that's something that if a producer out there has got really good quality high-protein wheat, they're actually getting a premium for their wheat. So even though you have to look at the broad spectrum, there, you know, little pockets of the ag business, or actually if you have that product, that there's a high demand for it. But in general, we had a really good year with very good quality.
If corn prices don't rebound anytime soon, do you expect these farmers to turn over their fields to something more profitable like the wheat?
I think so. It wouldn't actually probably be wheat, because wheat is at 10-year lows. And but I think what most farmers are looking at, especially in Wisconsin, it's going to be planting more soybeans.
Okay.
Soybeans at current prices are still profitable. It costs about half as much to put a soybean field in as it does corn. Again, that's, I'm speaking in generalities. And at these prices, at the end of the day, if you're borrowing money to plant a crop, you want to make sure that you're paying back your operating loan and you're making a profit. And that's the big decision, and people are anticipating that in 2017 we may have a shift in acres, not only in Wisconsin but across the nation, where farmers are going to put the pencil to paper and say, well, it makes more sense for us to grow beans. And, you know, that's one way, that's really the way supply and demand works. We will plant less corn, we'll grind through that supply, and hopefully it'll wash itself out, that we'll get back to where you'll have a little bit more demand. But right now, that's the biggest thing. There's a very large worldwide supply of grain, and so I think American farmers, they're going to have to make that decision this year. And they'll be making it, you know, at their kitchen table, or they'll be making it with their loan officer at the bank, because the banks are aware of where these farmers are sitting as well. So certainly not, you know, dire straits, but we'll be looking at probably more farmers planting more soybeans next year.
And really quickly, Chris, what does this all mean for our kitchen table, for our dinner tables? What does it mean for consumers?
Well, I think in general, I mean, the consumers, the benefits that, you know, when you have a large supply, prices stay low. You've seen that not only in the grain prices, but also in protein prices. Currently now, we're awash in supply of all forms of protein, not just to mention lean hogs. There's plenty of pork supply out there. There's plenty of chicken out there, and prices are depressed. We had a similar decrease in the price of beef, too. So while it's been negative if you're a producer or a farmer, it's positive at the end of the day, because the good supply keeps prices down.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you very much.
That was Chris Robinson, Senior Risk Management Specialist with Top Third Ag Marketing, LLC.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, a new study at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health is looking at risk factors for African Americans in developing Alzheimer's disease, including things like neighborhood stress.
First, when you think of a donkey or an elephant on, say, Election Day, What comes to mind?
If you're like many people, your mind likely jumps to the two major political parties of the United States.
Both the donkey and the elephant have served as symbols for the Democratic and Republican parties, respectively, for decades. But how did this come to be? What do those symbols mean, and why have they persisted as long as they have?
On this election day, we seek to answer these historical burning questions.
Historian Ken Davis joins us for a look at the history of the original party animals. He's the author of Don't Know Much About History, Everything You Need to Know About American History But Never Learned, and In the Shadow of Liberty. Ken, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back. Thanks for having me, and happy Election Day, and we all are happy it's here.
Well, both parties are hoping they come in first today, Ken. Which of these animal symbols came to be first?
Well, the first is the one of the oldest party of the two, and that's the Democrats. It was 1828, and it was actually not meant as a very complimentary thing that Andrew Jackson was called a jackass, but he kind of liked it and adopted Jackass Jackson as a name. He was quite comfortable with that idea, and it was not long before the donkey became established as the symbol of the Democratic Party. And while I'm saying that, this is in 1828, by the way, when the Democratic Party really was born. Before that, it had been called the Democratic Republicans. I have to just clean something up, because of my previous appearance, I had said it was the 1828 election that he fought with John Quincy Adams. That was actually 1824, came back 4 years later, and won the election of 1828. So I had my dates off last time. We want to make sure that we always keep things accurate.
And so how about that elephant for the GOP?
Well, the GOP elephant comes along a bit later. It's, of course, the Republican Party really comes along in the 1850s. 1856 is their first presidential nominee. John Charles Fremont was the Republican candidate. It was a party that grew out of a lot of splintered parties that had fractured over the years, the Whigs, the Know-Nothings, some of the abolitionist parties coalesced as the Republican Party, and they field a presidential candidate in 1856. It's, of course, in 1860 that Lincoln wins, and the idea of the elephant was actually discussed at that time, but not the image didn't really come about until the 1870s, and it's really Thomas Nast, the famous American political cartoonist, who really firms up both of these images in his cartoons, and they become completely linked with the two separate parties by that point. And we're talking about around 1874 and then in 1876.
Yeah, let's talk about Thomas Nast, because as you say, both these symbols kind of came together, and he really helped set them in concrete in a way for both those parties. Talk about him and the role he played in popularizing those.
Well, Nast was an extraordinary political cartoonist, most famous, especially in New York, for going after the Democratic machine in New York, Tammany Hall, as it was known. And he really went after them as for their corruption, and was quite vicious in skewering the Democratic Party and the Tammany Hall. He was a pretty much a loyal Republican himself, but by far one of the most influential political cartoonists and artists of his time. And we're talking about going from the 1870s and well into for the next 20 years or so. In addition to his political cartoons, of course, Nast is perhaps most famous for creating a version of Santa Claus and Uncle Sam that we're very familiar with. So when we think about those iconic images, they're really part of Nast's history. The other part of his history is a little bit different, which is that he was virulently anti-Catholic. And this is an important part of our political history that we don't talk about too much, but well into the 20th century, anti-Catholicism was, and especially Irish Catholics, were seen as the dangerous, dirty immigrants of their day. they were the alien immigrants that people feared in America, not just because they were taking jobs, because people feared that Catholics were coming into the country and they were actually going to take over the country and create a new Vatican for the Pope in this country. That was a very widely held view in America of the 19th century, most famously by the so-called Know Nothing Party, which briefly flourished for a bit in the 1830s and 40s before it was also eventually absorbed into the Republican Party.
It seems for cartoonists through time that these symbols have never fallen out of favor, that they've always been some go-to images for cartoonists. Is there something to that?
Well, I think that because NASP had created such permanent images, they did become iconic, and so there was no way around them. At one point, someone had used a fox. In fact, NASP himself had drawn, I believe, a fox for the Democrats, and it was just not quite as powerful. He also had shown a picture of the donkey kicking a lion at one point, and this is really before the Republican Party came into its heyday, and so though the lion and the fox never caught on quite the way the donkey and the elephant did.
Talking to Ken Davis, historian, author of Don't Know Much About History, looking at some of the finer points of American political history, where, among other things, the parties got their mascots. Was there something, Ken, that people latched onto later about the properties of those animals, the donkey or jackass, as Andrew Jackson was called, the elephant for the Republicans? Did they start to say, hey, there are positive traits of these animals that we think, yeah, represent us pretty well?
Well, that's the interesting part, I suppose, about Jackson himself in 1828 choosing to say, "Oh, I'm fine with that." He chose to use it for the rest of his career because he felt that this kind of stubborn animal that doesn't listen to anybody else was he was fine with that image even into his retirement. He was shown as a kind of a stubborn jackass, and Jackson was very happy with that. One other thing about the elephant we should mention is that one of the reasons it came into prominence that there was a Civil War expression widely used that when you went into battle, you were going to see the elephant. So it really came out of the Civil War and the elephant being something of a representation of the Civil War, which was, of course, a war that was led by a Republican president. So that notion of seeing the elephant as this battle imagery is also connected to the elephant, because we can think about it in terms of it's big, it's strong, it's powerful, but it had a very, very specific meaning during the Civil War.
And Ken, as you watch these symbols through time, as you've seen these cartoons through time and how these symbols have been used, has there ever been a time where they've really stood out to you as being sending a really powerful message?
You know, I think they it's not so much the message that they've sent is that they really become just so identifiable as icons, as symbols of the separate parties, just as the way we see the eagle and we think American eagle and symbol of the U.S. in that. So it's really less the totem value of these animals. I don't think anybody really thinks. I'm sure that there have been plenty about jokes over the centuries about Democrats being jackasses, fewer about Republicans as elephants. But, it's really much more of just that graphic hit that you see right away and you know exactly who we're talking about.
Now, a question occurred to me today, Ken, that I'd never thought of before. As you mentioned, the Democratic Party, substantially older than the Republican Party. Yeah, which one do we call the GOP, the grand old party? How did that come to be, that Republicans, the younger party, are the old party?
That's an interesting question. It really came about much more recently that I'm going to struggle for a moment to remember exactly who called it that, but it was not until well into the 20th century that the GOP got that that specific name, and I'm going to say it might have been perhaps Taft, one of the Tafts who came up with it. But you know, there's a lot of confusion about Republican and Democrat, because when Thomas Jefferson and James Madison were creating what eventually became the Democratic Party, they were first called the Democratic Republicans. So it was in a sense, it does go back that old, that long in American history, and we're talking about, you know, to the election of 1800. But it was not until late in the 19th century, maybe even the early 20th century, that a writer for one of the newspapers coined this phrase, Grand Old Party.
Well, Ken, are these elephants and donkeys here to stay well into the future? Are they with us now for eternity as the party symbols?
I suspect so. It's hard for me to imagine somebody saying, "Let's change the party symbol to something else." One other, because it's so fascinating, I think, and we are on a Tuesday. So many people do ask me about that as well. Why are we voting on Tuesday? And that is really a throwback to, we can blame it on the farmers. In the days when it took a long time to get to the county seat to vote, you needed 2 days to get there to vote. That's where the polling places were. You couldn't travel on Sunday, or you couldn't vote on Sunday, so it made sense that you traveled on a Monday and you voted on Tuesday, and then you would be able to go home. So that's really the throwback to the 19th century agricultural traditions of America as the reason we're voting on Tuesday. And many people have suggested that we should really rethink that a little bit. And of course, the fact that it was in November meant that was the kind of quiet time for farmers. The harvest was already in. It wasn't too cold yet, and so it made sense to make this a day in November, but a day where you didn't have to travel on the Sabbath. So that's why we vote on Tuesday.
And here we are today. Ken, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks so much. It was my pleasure, and you can find out more at don'tknowmuch.com.
That's Ken Davis, historian, author of Don't Know Much About History, Everything You Need to Know About American History But Never Learned. He joined us on this election day to give us the history behind, among other things, the Republican elephant and the Democratic donkey.
Coming up after the news, African Americans are twice as likely to develop Alzheimer's disease compared to Caucasians. A new UW study is looking at risk factors that could set the stage for the disease. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. I'm here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. Coming up, we'll talk about how communities in northeastern Wisconsin are being trained to better understand and respond to people living with Alzheimer's and dementia.
First, we'll look at the disease's impact on African Americans, who are twice as likely to develop Alzheimer's compared to Caucasians. A study underway at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health is trying to figure out why it affects one racial group more than another.
Clinical neuropsychologist Carrie Gleason joins us now to talk about the $3.8 million study. She's an associate professor of medicine with a focus on geriatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Carrie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for inviting me to be here.
You are enrolling hundreds of middle-aged African Americans for this study. Can you explain what the study is about?
Sure. We are going to look at modifiable risks in African Americans, and we're focused on prevention. So rather than wait until you have the disease, we'd like to really strive to look at how we can prevent it, in particular in African Americans.
And what are these modifiable risk factors that you're looking at?
Well, there are a number of different factors. The really interesting part is that this is the risk factors are most active during midlife. So cardiovascular risk factors, emotion, psychological function, even possibly neighborhood.
How are you going to look at these traits, look at these factors, as you follow these study participants?
Well, one of the first things we need to do is enroll a large enough cohort. So a big part of what we're going to do is double our current or existing cohort. We have between the Milwaukee RAP site, that stands for Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention, and our Madison group, enrolled in the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, we have about 250 African Americans. We're looking to double that to 500. So a big part of being able to dissociate these different causes and risk factors is to have a large enough sample. So once you've enrolled this group of individuals, what you want to be able to do is follow them over time. Our most powerful data are these data that tell us about change over time. So if you're looking at risk factors, you're going to start with a middle-aged cohort so that you can look at modifiable risk factors that you can hopefully affect or alter before people develop the disease.
Mm. And why are you focusing exclusively on African Americans? Is this community more at risk?
And that's absolutely. We know that African Americans are at increased risk compared to those groups who are at lower risk. So for late onset dementia, as was mentioned, African American men in particular approach the range of about twice the risk compared to the lowest risk group. And there was a study recently published that showed for late onset dementia that Asian Americans were the group that was at lowest risk, where in African American men, as I mentioned, were almost twice the risk. African American women had about a 50% increased risk.
And so when you hear the term Alzheimer's disease, dementia, used sometimes almost interchangeably, what's the difference between them and what is your research focused on, one or the other or both?
That's a really good question. That's probably the most popular question I get when I'm out giving talks in the community. Dementia is the syndrome. It's what you can see. It's the behaviors associated with, for example, with memory loss or with not being able to manage day-to-day tasks. Alzheimer's disease is the most common cause. So it's either a single cause or in combination with another form of dementia. We know that African Americans are at increased risk both for Alzheimer's disease dementia as well as other forms of dementia as well. We know that the really interesting thing is when you dissociate this as a disease versus a syndrome, the disease itself, the current thinking is that it starts decades before the onset of symptoms. So think about this. If average age of dementia onset is in your 70s, when would you want to target prevention measures, or when would you want to start prevention? Midlife. And again, midlife is turning out to be a really key time to look at the disease. The risk factors are most active during midlife. For example, diabetes. If you develop diabetes in midlife, it raises your risk for dementia and Alzheimer's disease dementia. If you develop it in your 80s, it's not associated with increased risk for dementia. So midlife is turning out to be a really key time.
Which is why you're keying in for your study participants to be middle-aged.
Yeah, and for African Americans in particular, whose risks for diabetes and hypertension, high cholesterol, all risk factors for Alzheimer's disease, dementia, those are higher prevalence in those groups.
We're talking with neuropsychologist Carrie Gleason. She's an associate professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, talking about a new study that undergoing for African Americans and following them for many years to look at risk of Alzheimer's disease. Carrie, what about neuroimaging and biomarkers? How are they factors in your study?
They're one of our major outcomes. When you look at prevention studies or looking at people who don't have symptoms, you're talking about what's called a preclinical stage. And in the preclinical stage, if you can't measure symptoms or onset of the disease, you've got to have a biomarker. So a typical biomarker, a definition of a biomarker is a biological measurement that you then tells you about something about the underlying disease. So a classic example of a biomarker is your blood pressure. In and of itself, it's not as meaningful. it's meaningful because it tells you about your heart, your risk for heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
So the traditional biomarkers in Alzheimer's disease typically are neuroimaging biomarkers and then looking at proteins in the cerebral spinal fluid, so those two areas. So for our study, we're looking at neuroimaging biomarkers that include your certain structures of the brain, measuring the volume of those structures, in particular the hippocampus, because
mm-hmm.
We know that the hippocampus is shrinking before you develop symptoms. So looking at the size of the hippocampi using neuroimaging techniques, and then also looking at the proteins in cerebral spinal fluid, and those proteins are directly related to the Alzheimer's disease pathology. So the beta amyloid proteins as well as the tau proteins.
So you really have even the chemistry to back up what you're seeing as you track these participants in their daily life.
Yes, and this is what people will, to take this work seriously, you have to have these traditional biomarkers in a preclinical study. Very important. But we've been responding to what the community has said, too. I've gotten this question in the community. Why don't you develop a non-invasive biomarker, or one that doesn't require a brain scan or a cyclotron, where you're if you're going to look at amyloid plaques, and we've so we're targeting, we're trying to look at cognitive markers too. So this would be something that you could actually go out to the community with a paper and pencil test and look for these subtle cognitive changes that maybe are not in a raw score per se, but there's some pattern that might emerge that would be helpful in terms of a biomarker.
And in your study, you said something really interesting at the beginning. One of the traits that you're tracking is neighborhood stress.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. It turns out your zip code is pretty powerful, and I have a collaborator, Dr. Amy Kind, who has looked at this in terms of rehospitalization. Your neighborhood is probably a marker for many other psychosocial, environmental, economic stressors that probably play into the overall picture.
And you think Alzheimer's relates to that as well?
Well, we're going to look at it because it is one of these potentially modifiable factors. It's one thing to focus on your genetics or your parental history. Those things you can't change. And this is why it's really important for every avenue we go down with the intention of looking at how we can modify it.
And how can people find out more about your study or enrolling in your study?
Oh, so the website, you go to the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, go to the website, and look for our outreach coordinator. I want to mention in particular my partnerships to make this work possible. So there's one thing to write the grant and be successful at that, but it's incredibly important to have key partners. And I've got Ms. Charlie Daniel, who's at the Alzheimer's and Dementia Alliance, who's passionate about helping families affected by the disease. And I've also got a partner within our team who really leads our outreach work, who really makes this happen. Like I said, it's one thing to write the grant, but you need people on your team who really make things happen.
Well, Carrie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was clinical neuropsychologist Carrie Gleason, an associate professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She joined us to talk about her new federal grant that's looking at the impact of Alzheimer's disease in African American communities.
Coming up, a related topic, we'll talk to a guest from the Behavioral Health Training Partnership at UW Green Bay about how they're working to train people to better understand and respond to people with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia.
We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Happy Election Day. Tonight after 7, you can hear state and national coverage of election returns here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
First, earlier this fall, the Behavioral Health Training Partnership at UW Green Bay received a $95,000 grant to help improve understanding and crisis response for people living with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia.
Sharon Lachlan is with us now to talk about this new grant, about how it works and the partnership and what it's doing in northeastern Wisconsin. She's the training manager for the Behavioral Health Training Partnership at UW Green Bay. She joins us from our studios there. Sharon, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be on. Thank you for having me.
Explain, first of all, what is the Behavioral Health Training Partnership?
Sure. We were formed in 2009 by regional county human services directors to train people about crisis response. I don't know if people are aware of this, but every county in Wisconsin needs to have a crisis program to respond to mental health emergencies. And while counties were providing that, there was no standardized curriculum for training crisis workers, and there are state standards about training. So we developed a training curriculum, and we've been training crisis workers, and we've expanded our trainings now to cover more behavioral health type topics. We also have been working with youth and adolescents, doing training around some of their needs, and most recently now we got this grant to deal with dementia issues and to train on that.
And when we talk about, when we say behavioral health, what does that mean?
Well, some people don't even like that term because it implies that, you know, a judgment about people's behavior, whether it's good or bad. And we use it because it's more all-inclusive. When you do crisis response, you're dealing with people who may have intellectual disabilities. You may be dealing with children, adolescents, elderly people, people with mental health issues, people who have lost a job and are very traumatized about something in their life. And not feeling like they can go on, so they need some support. So it's a range of issues, and that's why it's hard to just say mental health, because it could be other issues that are causing some of the situations that crisis responders have to deal with.
And who are you training as part of this work?
Well, we are training clinicians, we're training crisis workers, we're training people who work in the county system that have to respond, and their partners, law enforcement, ER workers, people that work in assisted living and nursing homes will be a target group for this grant because that they come in contact with people with dementia so often. We are collaborating with the Alzheimer's Association because they do already have a curriculum on first responder training, and so they're going to be providing some of that training, but we're building on that to go more in depth for the people that have to work with people with dementia on a day-to-day basis to prevent them from ending up held against their will in psychiatric hospitals or institutions and keep them more comfortable in their homes and in their community for a longer period of time.
And so what is this training trying to convey to your groups? What are some of the themes that you're working on that apply to these people afflicted with Alzheimer's or dementia?
Well, I think as you heard from the previous guest, there are a lot of factors that play into dementia, and some of them are genetic, and this is really a health condition. People aren't purposely trying to behave in a way that challenges other people. They're not trying to drive when they're not supposed to be. They're not trying to create problems in society. They're not able to think beyond the moment they're in because of the changes that are going on in their brain. So we want people to approach them differently because we want them to understand how it feels and what's happening to the brain that causes some of these behaviors. All behavior has meaning. It's really trying to reflect an unmet need for the person. And people who respond can either help calm that person down, or their response can further escalate the situation. So it's really important that we teach people to be trauma-informed, that we teach them that this is a medical condition, that they're not being difficult just to make your life miserable, and that there are appropriate responses that can help de-escalate the situation.
We're talking with Sharon Lachlan. She's training manager for the Behavioral Health Training Partnership at UW Green Bay. Talk a little bit, if you could, about the grant itself and what you're seeing in terms of the need for this grant and the demand for this training through the Behavioral Health Training Partnership.
Sure. We've had a lot of requests ongoing since, early 2000. to start dealing more with dementia for crisis workers. There are a lot of crisis workers that are new graduates out of school. It's not training they usually get when they're in college. It's kind of a specialty type training. And so we've had a lot of requests for it over the years. The state actually put together a state work group to deal with dementia because they saw all the gaps in services in the communities for people with dementia. As a result of that, there have been some really good changes going on in the state. Besides the exciting research you just heard about earlier, there are things happening like dementia-friendly communities are being created, and that's another piece of our grant. We want to identify several counties that are willing to work with us on becoming dementia-friendly. Counties like Brown County has been very active in trying to create a dementia-friendly community. So taking some of what they've learned and then bringing it to the next county can be very helpful to all of the counties in our region. So that's another piece of it.
And Sharon, what does it mean to be dementia-friendly? Can you explain that?
Sure. Not only do the first responders and the crisis workers get training, but people that work in banks or local businesses, they get training. Some communities have come up with cute little signs they can put in their windows to indicate that this business has been trained in dementia and how to approach people with dementia. So it's all about raising community awareness and eliminating some of the stigma that goes along with people that have dementia.
Sharon, how will you know that this grant is doing what it should, that it's making a difference?
Well, one of the things we're going to look at least with the crisis workers, is are they doing more crisis response in place, meaning at the nursing home, at the person's home, instead of having the police transport them to a hospital. One of the problems that happens is once they get to the hospital, then the nursing home doesn't want to take them back because they're afraid that they might be cited because the person's been threatening to other patients in the nursing home and things like that. And so it can be the person can spend a long time in the hospital while people scramble to find another placement. So it's very, very difficult. And there's also that whole element of transfer trauma that happens when you take somebody out of their home environment and put them in an institutional environment like that. It's very scary for the person. So they need their routine, and that's really important. So if you can do the response at their home or at the nursing home where they live, it's much better for this person. So we're going to be measuring that. The other things are just how many communities are really trying to do the dementia-friendly piece of it and are getting their community partners trained. So we'll be looking at that as well.
And when will the training kick off? And who will be the first wave of people to get this training?
Well, the first wave of people are going to be the trainers themselves. We are actually working with a geriatric social worker at UW-Madison who's helping us develop the curriculum, and she will be providing training to the trainers that are then going to go out and train people in the communities. That first wave, we hope, is going to happen in April. She's working on the curriculum already, so we're hoping that that'll get off the ground in April, and that we will have statewide trainings up and running through the summer. We are also developing what they call a learning collaborative, because we know training alone is not enough. You need to put things into practice, so you need follow-up. And the learning collaborative is going to be a way to try and sustain the effort after the grant is done this summer, so that people can come to the learning collaborative and participate in that, get their skills updated, bring cases to review, things like that. So we're going to have an ongoing learning loop after the trainings have been held.
I understand you also have an event on November 17th looking for input about needs.
Yes, we are having our kickoff meeting to educate people about what the grant will be doing and look for communities to volunteer to be part of this grant on November 17th here on campus at University Union in the Christie Theater. So it'll be at 9 a.m. We'll be wrapped up by noon on November 17th.
What do you hope to learn on that day?
Well, we're hoping that communities are going to come forward and say, we want you to work with us and help us become more dementia friendly. We're hoping to learn that what some of the successful communities have been doing and get some blueprints to work with other communities. We do have some because the state has put out some pamphlets. Department of Health Services has a wonderful pamphlet that they put out about creating dementia-friendly communities.
Sharon, thanks for joining us. That was Sharon Lachlan, Training Manager for the Behavioral Health Training Partnership at UW Green Bay.
Yesterday, we talked about some soothing anti-anxiety music for election season with Stephen Thompson from NPR Music. If you're looking for some last-minute calm, we have his listening list available to help you out.
You can find Stephen's recommendations over at WPR.org or on the Central Time Facebook page, and we've got links to his five tracks.
And we got some recommendations from you online after the show. On WPR.org, Tim recommends David Sylvian, Gone to Earth.
On Facebook, Trevor says, I would like to nominate the band The Bird and the Bee. They made an album of Hall & Oates covers that I find especially relaxing.
I haven't listened to that yet. I can go for that, I guess. Catherine recommends Cricket's Wicket by Night Noise. That is one I have not heard of, but we can check it out.
Mel said, Here Comes a Thought, Steven Universe. It's a song apparently about mindfulness meditation.
And today I'm seeing a lot of Election Day counter-programming online. Site saying, hey, we're not going to do any politics in this zone here. Kate, do you have any go-to calming songs?
I would say, in general, Philip Glass.
Right. I used to listen to Philip Glass a lot. Yeah.
Getting me out of a moment and into another.
It focuses your brain, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Stephen and I mentioned the band Sigur Rós. He gave me the pronunciation of that yesterday. We'll go out with a little of that to calm you down as you wait for election returns here on WPR. This is Central Time.
Skinny.